Good afternoon. So, last time we talked a bit about what an operating system was. I mentioned that there were kind of a variety of definitions. We all had this central idea of making things more convenient for applications, or at the least, putting something between normal applications and the hardware to get more functionality that we wanted, or at least more convenience than we would have if we were using the underlying hardware directly. We talked about some more specific parts of an OS, starting with the idea of user and kernel mode, that one of our goals in abstracting the hardware was that the operating system would be responsible for ensuring that applications could cooperate with each other without interfering with each other, and that when hardware devices were accessed, they were done in a way which was okay for the operating system, you only read your own files, and so on. And we have this hardware mechanism for supporting that of kernel mode, that some special dangerous operations, like talking directly to most devices, would only be allowed in this kernel mode, and the kernel mode would be something that the OS would take care of and do that dangerous operation, and normal user code would run in user mode. Now, to support this, we needed some way of switching between user and kernel mode, and it also turned out we needed ways of having the OS run even when there was no instruction we were running that would cause it to do so directly. So, notably, if I press a key on the keyboard, we want the OS to handle that. We don't want it to wait for whatever program's currently running to finish up whatever it's doing, because, well, it might not. Especially if we think about some shared system like the department machines, USSHN, you run your broken algorithms homework that has an infinite loop. We want other people to still be able to press keys or send things on the network and use that machine. So our mechanism for both getting into kernel mode and allowing the OS to run in these cases was exceptions. So this is hardware support to help operating systems be written to run the OS when needed. And this is both used deliberately by applications when they want to do something that requires kernel mode, like change their address space mapping. They make a system call, which is a special kind of exception, to ask the operating system to do it for them. And they have to use that special mechanism, because if they just call the function, it's still going to be in user mode and it won't be able to help them. And it's also used to handle those things like input or to stop programs from running for too long if we want some other program to run and so on. We also took a very deep dive into the path of a system call in XV6, which was relevant in particular because the first homework is going to be to write a new system call and also modify one of the existing ones, so that's going to be very useful to know for next week. And we also talked a bit about logistics. So before I move on from these topics from last time, anything people would like me to go over, questions, crisis of confusion? We're all tentatively good. Okay. So last time I had some technical issues, so we weren't actually doing some demos I wanted to do, and one of them was a demo of our quiz tool. So this is what it looks like. It will be at a different URL. You can go to the course website and there's a quizzes link at the top that should help you find it. And the general way it's going to work is that you'll be able to start a quiz. You can enter in whatever answers you like. When your answer is recorded, it will return green around there. Then that means the answer is recorded. If it says yellow with a red border, it is not recorded. There's some sort of network problem or something like that. You can write comments. So you can write a comment and it's saved when you focus outside of the box where you type the comment. We will eventually have someone read those comments and decide whether the comment suggests that you really knew what was going on. So if you think, for example, that I wrote a question horribly and it doesn't make any sense, please write a comment explaining that and choose your best choice for the answer in spite of that. And we'll have someone read that comment later on, and if it turns out you were right, we'll give you credit. And if it turns out you weren't, we won't do anything. But we'll have someone read it eventually. When that happens, you'll know. So questions, flies, and after the close date, which is listed on the page for the quiz, you'll be able to see the correct answers, at least what we marked as the correct answers in our key, which will hopefully be mostly correct, along with, once we look at your comment, any responses to that, and these percentages here, which are what percent of students answered each possible option. So you can get an idea of, like, was this a question everyone missed, or, you know, i.e., for me, is it something I probably should go over in lecture, or is it just something where you had a misunderstanding that's not common among your peers, apparently, or they just guessed right. Okay, so that's, any questions about quizzes? So this is, so those are, as I said in the first lecture, after every week, a few questions, and they're more of the grade this semester than last, so please actually do them. Also, if you're used to 2150, sorry, 3330, we dropped quizzes, we're not doing that, so. Unless, like, you're sick or something like that. But we're generally not just automatically dropping quizzes. Okay, so, doing good. Questions? Okay. So, another topic was I was wanting to do a demo of what XV6 looks like. So, let's do... Okay, yep. Remember how this works. And so let's do that. So when you, after you follow the instruction to clone our repository for XV6, you'll get a directory that looks kind of like this, though without some of the files I have here, like the submission file. And you'll run make, and that will actually compile it, hopefully, if you have an appropriate system. And after you're done with that, use make with a different targets to actually run it. So you can run make QEMU, and that will pop up a window that looks like this, which I will make full screen. So you'll get a window like this, which is actually XV6 booting. It boots to a shell. Now, XV6 is trying to be very small, so this may be less featureful than you're used to. So for example, if I type ls, there's an ls command. It's not as pretty as the ls command you may be used to, but it's ls. It's listing all the files. So we have a dot, 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 readme, cat, echo. There's ls, the program we're running. And this is like size and some other information about the files. You can, not important exactly what that is. Program. And so on. So, and there's other programs we can run. So there's an echo program, which prints out its arguments. I showed you the source code to that yesterday. You can run that. There's also a shutdown program, which shuts it down. And yes, it says it failed. That's just because shutting it down causes it QEMU to exit with a failed exit status. It doesn't mean anything's actually wrong. And the QEMU directory has all the things used to start it. So you can look in here and you'll see, for example, we know we had the ls program. If you want to know what it is, it's an ls.c. I just opened up ls.c in a text editor. And this is the source code to ls. And that's going to be true for all the utilities and all parts of the OS. Yeah. Question is there any logging? So what do you mean by logging?
Like, so I saw those shell commands are based on like C programs.
Yeah.
Do those programs produce like a log somewhere?
So the question is, do those programs produce like a log? Those programs write output to the terminal. So we saw that there was a separate window that popped up. It turns out that when you do that, QEMU also outputs that to your normal, or XV6 also outputs that to the terminal I ran the make command in, which you can see here, like I ran make, and you can see the ls command I typed is visible there too. So it's visible in that sense if you like you went to look afterwards. Now, as for like writing to a file, well, these files are all in a virtual file system that's in a file called xv6.image, I believe, or fs.image. So there's an so if we look in here, there's a in this directory, which well, there's too much now. There's an fs.image in this directory, which is a 512 kilobyte file, basically, and that is where the files are stored. So if you can write files from those C programs, but they're going to be stored inside that this file outside of QEMU. So that's not probably, if you want to like do debugging, the useful thing is to have something that's sent out to the terminal like the output of LS.
Is it possible
to
output to the QEMU terminal?
Yes. In fact, if you saw when I ran command, if we scroll up here, like the output of LS ended up is here on the terminal. So if you just output normally, it's going to be there. So when you're debugging, like you'll run something, then it crashes, you have the output on the terminal there. Which I assume is what you're worried about.
Yes.
Great. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
Is there a compiler within
XV6? Question is there a compiler within XV6? No. So the only way to create that we support to create programs in XV6 is to compile them outside of XV6. The same way like LS is compiled and put in that file system image, that thing that the OS boots on. And the main reason for that is that, well, you saw like LS is very underfeatured and still took up more than a screenful. Imagine what a compiler would be. That's why they didn't do it. Okay, yeah. Okay, like you went. So the question is, like, what's the equivalent of Control C? So that's a good question, and there's not great answers. So, like, if I run QEMU with a separate window here, like, and you know, I want to stop running it. Probably the easiest thing to do is to go to my terminal here and just. That also doesn't work because those also types in the terminal. So probably the easiest thing to do is to go to another window, which I can't actually show by doing it in there. Is to go to another terminal. There's another terminal and do something like kill all QEMU with a QEMU system i386, which you can look up. So if I go to PS. Of grep QEMU. So if I look up in your VM, you would do this with looking at the screen, and probably you'd open up the process monitor tool or something graphical, rather, but I can't easily set that up. So you look up, oh, it's called QEMU system i386. That's really helpful. And now I should be able to kill all QEMU system i386. And if I go back to my other window, I killed it. So unfortunately, it's inconvenient. Basically, you want to kill the terminal it's running. You have to find its process using a tool like PS, or probably there's a graphical process monitor tool you can find to find its name and then kill it. Or you can probably use a graphical process monitor to kill it. But yes, there's not actually a great, convenient way if, like, you accidentally run an infinite loop program. Okay, other questions? Okay. So, that's my demo of XV6 then. Okay, so when we left off last time, we talked about our write system call. And one thing we mentioned was that the write system call, we have these part of it, which is run in user mode. So we had this write function that we called from, for example, from our normal C program that ran in user mode. And that write function was a user mode function. Apparently. Was a user mode function, and that actually made the special instruction to enter kernel mode. And that triggered an exception and actually started executing the kernel code that we traced through, that we had this bunch of wrapper functions, and ultimately it executed this trap function, which figured out that, oh, the reason I got here is because it was a write system call, and executed the syswrite function, and finally the syswrite function figured out, okay, what am I writing? Where am I writing it? And it turned out by reading the arguments to this original write function from the user stack. And one thing, in addition to having separate user mode and kernel mode, we actually have separate stacks for each case. And we decided to do that. One reason is because we don't want it to matter how much space is left on the user stack or whether there's space. We still want the system call to work the same way. So we use a separate stack. So to help us do this, first of all, we have a convention in XV6 that these larger addresses up here in XV6, they just have chosen that those are only going to be used by the kernel in kernel mode. So when XV6 loads user programs, they get loaded in this green portion, this which is addresses 0 through a value called kernbase. And that's where the user programs get loaded. They never actually use any of this memory. And that means that they can allocate some space for the kernel stack up here. And XV6 arranges using the x86 feature to switch stacks whenever an exception or interrupt happens. And the subtle thing is I said that they're kernel stacks. So there's actually one kernel stack per process. And we'll talk about why that is later. But it's not just that there's one kernel stack, but every process has its own kernel stack in XV6. This is a design decision they have made. Yes?
Would multiple threads then use that same stack?
The question is, would multiple threads then use one kernel stack? That's a great question. Because you might say, well, that means that there's one kernel stack that corresponds to multiple user stacks. So XV6 avoids this issue by having every process have exactly one thread. So the answer is no because of that. And this is, again, a design decision, and might not be the best design, but it's one of the simpler ones, which is why XV6 does it. So one detail of this, I said we switch to the kernel stack when we have an exception. Well, this isn't actually quite true, because we have nested exceptions. So for example, if we have a system call, we'll switch to kernel mode, start executing exception, then we could have a timer interrupt during that system call. And XV6 doesn't stop this from happening. So it can be the case that you make a system call, in the middle of the system call, the timer goes off to tell XV6, hey, you've been running this program for too long. And what happens in XV6 in that case is that it continues using the same kernel stack. It just goes and pushes more things on top of it for the timer interrupt, above the stuff that was handling the system call. Yes?
Will it choose whether or not it needs to queue the nested exception, or will it always interrupt the current exception handler?
The question is, will XV6 choose whether or not it needs to queue the exception or not? Or versus, wait for later or not? So XV6 has made a decision about when it tells the processor, hey, give me these exceptions right now, and hey, don't. And the decision XV6 has made is very simple. And that decision is that it's going to say, if it's not a system call, I don't want exceptions while I'm handling an exception. Otherwise, if it's a system call, feel free, give me all the other exceptions while I'm handling a system call. And this is a choice they've made, and it has some disadvantages. So one disadvantage is, let's say I press a key, and it takes a really long time to figure out what to do about that. With this design, if I press a key and it takes a really long time, that's going to freeze my whole system, because there's no timer interrupts that are going to be allowed to happen. And that's just a consequence of this choice, but it makes things simpler because now I don't have to worry about what if I press a key and then I want to switch to a different program while I'm handling that key press. So XV6 has decided, well, system calls could take a really long time. I want to make sure that doesn't stop me from like switching to another program or handling a key press right away. But other things, you know, I do want to stop. Yeah? The question is, what happens if we need to page in memory from disk? We will get to that much later in the semester, probably. The short answer is XV6 doesn't do paging. So that solves that problem. Yeah?
It sounds like, what if you just held a key down, so you just constantly send the machine interrupts?
So a question is, like, couldn't I, like, given this, make the system really, really slow by just constantly giving input and constantly causing interrupts to happen? And your idea is like holding a key down. So the answer is yes. If you do something which continuously gives input, it turns out holding a key down won't do that. But there are things you could do, like moving a mouse really, really fast, like potentially could slow the system down. It's the case that input devices aren't going to actually have a high enough rate to actually cause a problem. And with key presses in particular, there's some work the operating system is doing to simplify the hardware interface that makes it not actually work the way that you'd intuitively think. You think, I press a key down, it keeps sending that key. But what's really happening underneath is it sends, I press the key down, and when I unpress the key, it sends, I unpress the key. And that the key being repeated is something the operating system is doing to make the keyboard interface easier for applications to use than the actual raw keyboard interface. Okay, good questions. So other questions? Okay. So a nice thing about the decision that XV6 doesn't allow nested exceptions for anything but system calls is that when you're writing code for XV6, there's lots of things where you might have to worry about, what if I had a timer interrupt while I was doing this, where you might not have to worry about that. Okay, so we mentioned like interrupts. So let's talk about sort of one application of interrupts. So this is an example I've sometimes used in 3330. So let's say I have a loop where I'm doing nothing, and if there were no exceptions, I would expect that I would get the same amount of time basically every time. And that's because, well, the same number of instructions run, once I have all my caches all set up, it's just going to keep being the same. And if you run this empirically, that isn't what happens. And you get this whole wide variety of the amounts of time that are spent in that this part of the loop right here. We're subtracting the time between here and here. It should be constant, and it's very much not constant. And not only is it not constant, but it goes by order of magnitudes. And in particular, we have these really high things where we're taking, you know, 7 orders of magnitude, well, six orders of magnitude more time than the actual minimum time. And this is not a caching thing. This is after we filled all our caches. So what do you think's happening in there? Why would this be happening? Yeah.
Maybe replacing registers instead of like context switching or something.
Okay. So you're saying context switching. So what's context switching?
When you change, when like an interrupt comes in, you have to replace all the variables and the stuff in memory to another stack so that you get like their processing data.
Okay, so you're saying we need to replace everything with another process. So what you're saying is not only are we doing this context switch operation of changing to another process, but presumably if we're doing that, we're actually running the other process for a while. And yes, and that is in fact most likely what's happening here. That's why it takes so long, is that we're actually giving the other process, you know, around 10 to the 7 nanoseconds to run. And it's likely that these smaller times are something like I pressed a key and I need to handle that. It doesn't take as much time as like letting my web browser display its window, but it still takes some amount of time. Okay, so question over here. Yeah. Okay, so up here it's saying that we're taking, you know, like 10 to the 7 nanoseconds to do apparently nothing. So what's probably happening in there is that I was running this on a system with other programs. Like maybe I had my web browser running, and the web browser needs time to like display the page, so that might have been the time it was running. That. Arthur? Yeah.
So would it be less common for the process to take a higher time to run in a system with like higher number of threads?
The question is, if we have more threads, and I assume you mean more hardware threads, more processors, more cores, would this happen less often? And the answer is probably, yeah, because we have more other places we could run that and not interrupt this program, which, you know, although, like, it's very unproductive, it's, from the operating system's point of view, it always wants to use the processor, and it always would seem like a bad, you know, worse to not give it the processor than to give it the processor. Yeah.
Could this entirely be avoided by putting a critical section around that?
The question is, could a critical section avoid that? We'll talk about critical sections later, and we'll answer that question much more thoroughly. But we don't know what a critical section is. Most of us don't know yet, so we'll get to that later. So this is an example of various, sorry.
On the diagram you had a few slides before where you're, that one.
Yes.
When you're following the system call, if you go from the system call directly back to user mode, how do you clear the stack frames from all of the calls on the way?
So the question is, the question is this operation, you're saying, gosh, there was all this stuff in the kernel stack, we need to do something about that. So I omitted some details, and the way this happens is we return from trap, and we return from the syswrite, which returns from trap, returns from syscall, which returns from trap. So we were just doing all the returns to get rid of those stack frames. So I just didn't have boxes for all of them because the slide has enough stuff on it already. Good question. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. So we have our example here running other programs. And this brings us to like sort of thinking about all the non-system call exceptions. So I mean, we have most notably timer interrupts, which are probably what are triggering these, which is that, well, if I'm running an infinite loop, my operating system might decide that maybe I shouldn't only be running that program with an infinite loop. Maybe I want to run some other program, like the terminal where I'm typing the kill command to get rid of it. And it needs some way of deciding that I really should run something else if something's been running too long. So there's something called a timer interrupt. And basically, built in on the same chip as the CPU, but conceptually an external thing, is a timer. And that timer periodically does the equivalent of pressing a key to wake up the processor and let the operating system decide what to do. And the operating system typically uses this to make sure programs don't hog the CPU. And also, this is probably going to be how it implements things like if you call a function like sleep in your program to make it wait for like 60 seconds, this is probably how the processor will implement that, is it will count timer interrupts until that time has expired. There's also some other things which trigger exceptions. So we mentioned I/O. If I press a key, we need to handle that. It also happens for output, because for example, if I have a Wi-Fi card, I need to know when can I actually send something on that. So there might be an exception where that the Wi-Fi radio tells me, hey, I'm ready for new data now. And the operating system will handle that. And there's also this category of faults, which is like if I access invalid memory. So we need to handle that. And the reason we need to handle that is like if the program accesses invalid memory, the processor doesn't know what to do. Like it can't just keep running it. It has to put something in that register or do something else. So it asks the OS what to do. And XV6 has made a very simple decision for most of these, which is it just kills the program. But it needs to know to do that, and it needs to have the OS do that, because only the OS knows how to, after the program is killed, how to run something else. Okay. So we have these other types of exceptions, and let's look at how they're handled in XV6. Like what the code looks like. And we saw, when we talked about how the system call handler was set up, we saw this interrupt descriptor table, and we had an entry for system calls. It has an entry for all the other kinds of exceptions, and we saw this being set for syscalls. Well, XV6 sets all the entries and makes them all go to the trap function in a very similar way as it does for system calls. So every type of exception goes to the trap function. And that's just because we saw this code earlier for setting that table entry for system calls. Right above it, there's this loop that sets it for everything else in a slightly different way, but it's the same idea. It's just setting the same type of table entry to say, go to this wrap function, which we'll call the trap function. People look moderately confused, so. Yeah?
Why don't they go directly to the handler function?
So the question is, why don't they go directly to the handler function? This is a design decision XV6 made. So it does seem kind of silly. Like, why did we have these separate entries? Why didn't I, your question is, why didn't we set, instead of vector syscall here, why did we not have, just put syscall here, right? Why don't we just have it go directly to syscall? And the biggest reason is we have this common code to save the registers. So we need to go to syscall plus save plus restore registers. So rather than duplicate that code, they have that code in one place, and that's what the trap function is called from. So there's one copy of the save all the registers code. And other operating systems do this differently. So sometimes they will actually go directly to the handler rather than having a common entry point. But this is probably why XV6 chose not to do that, even though it seems like we have this giant, nice, convenient table the processor made that we're totally ignoring. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at what's in this trap function. I showed you the top of the trap function, or part of the trap function where system calls are handled. Let's look at the part which handles timer interrupts. So this is the part of the trap function code which is relevant to timer interrupts. And I'll first start with the part which deals with what if my program's in an infinite loop and I need to stop it? And there's this code down here, and that if statement says, if a program is running right now, if there's a current program and the current program is running, and we had a timer exception, not some other type, says that's why it's checking trap no, say, is this a timer exception, not like a system call, then call this yield function. And the yield function, which we'll talk much more about when we talk about how the scheduler works, decides maybe I'll switch to a different program, maybe I won't. But it's the thing which says, maybe this program's been running for too long and I should run something else. Okay. There's also some other code which happens with the timer interrupt, and that's this code up here. And what it does is if it's a timer interrupt in this switch statement, it sometimes calls this wake up function. And what this is for is implementing the sleep system call. So XV6 has a system call where you can say, put my process to sleep for n units of time. And the way that's implemented is that this code in wakeup checks have n units of time passed every time the timer interrupt happens for all the programs which called sleep. Also, next to this, it keeps track of a number of ticks, just as a, this is XV6 tracking the current time, but in a very crude way, because we can't really translate that to like hours, minutes, and seconds. There's also this funny thing here, EIO. And you see this a lot in the code, like looks very puzzling. This is a function which tells the hardware, I have handled this interrupt, stop giving it to me. If you don't do this, the hardware might think you haven't handled it and think you want to keep getting it. And that's why you see that a bunch in the XV6 source code. There's also some, there's an acquire and release here. We will talk about this a lot later when we talk about synchronization. So any questions on anything I showed here? And so I mentioned we have faults. And I said XV6 kills the program. And you can see the code which does that, again, in the trap function. So I showed you the switch statement earlier. The switch statement has a default case. So if it's not a timer interrupt or any of the other kinds of interrupts that are handled, the default case, it prints out a message with a bunch of information, like the process ID, the name of the program that was running. And then it marks it as killed. And just does this for every type of exception that XV6 doesn't know about. And hopefully most of those are things like seg faults and the equivalent, and divide by zero and so on. And something worth noting is that this prints out the trap number. So it prints out that number, which like could be, is it for a system call or something else? You can look up these numbers in traps.h. And I'm mentioning this because sometimes you'll write code which causes a seg fault, the equivalent of a seg fault, or causes a divide by zero, and you want to know what was happening. And you'll get this print statement to run because it's not going to crash QEMU, it's just going to ask the OS, hey, someone divided by zero, what do I do? And this is XV6's code for like something like that. So you might have to read these messages to figure out why is my, you know, write count implementation not working. Okay. Questions? And the third type I mentioned here is handling I/O. So a lot of the code in the trap function is handling I/O. We will talk later in the semester in more detail about what is the interface to input and output devices. But you can see this in, for example, here we have IRQ IDEs for the disk, the virtual disk in the case of QEMU. We have a keyboard, and COM1 is for the serial port, the virtual serial port, that just was an old way of connecting a terminal to a machine that XV6 uses. Or thinks it's using with QEMU. And in each case, you can see that we call some handler that's somewhere else in the XV6 source code, and then call this function to tell the hardware, hey, I handled it. Don't tell me about this anymore. Yes, I got the key press. We're done. Don't need to keep telling me. And something that will happen in this code, so we have like a key press, it eventually gets to something which sometimes calls something like wake up, which is the function to say, oh, a process was waiting on this, let's wake it up. Let's make it run sometime soon. So it is possible that, you know, after a whole bunch of function calls, we decide a different program should start running. Okay. So questions? So, talked about different types of exceptions, and we alluded to the fact that we run other programs, that we have what is known as time multiplexing, that in those large delays, we're running something else, like my SSH client or my web browser, and we know that that happens because we do what was mentioned, a context switch, that we go from one program to another. So an exception happens, and somehow the operating system makes sure it returns in a different program. And conceptually, what's happening is that, you know, we save the old registers and program counters somewhere, we set the new ones for the new program we want to run, and go there. So sort of the pictorial form is that, you know, the CPU has the registers for process A, then an exception happens and we decide, oh, process A has been running for too long, let's start running process B, and the OS has a copy of process B's registers in its memory, and it switches between them, saves process A's, and starts running process B. This is the basic idea. So questions on this procedure? And in XV6, we can actually say, where is this memory location? And we've actually already seen it. And it's the trap frame. It's that thing that is the argument to the trap function. That is exactly where we save it. It's, in fact, the code which saves it. And we'll go into more detail about that in later today. First, let's talk about context switches. So let's say, just a little exercise question, say I have two programs. I have one program that runs an infinite loop, and I have another program which reads from the keyboard. After it gets its input from the keyboard, it reads from a file, then it does a computation and writes the result to a screen. So, you know, these two programs are running at the same time. Process B does all this stuff. So how many system calls are there? And how many context switches would you expect there to be? And your answer might be a range. So I'll give you a minute to think about that. You can check with your neighbor to see if you agree on what should happen.
Okay, so I presume you
in the file, yeah. Okay. So people seem to be calming down maybe. So anyone want to volunteer any answer for either part? No one. Okay, one person?
Two system calls.
Two system calls, okay. So where do you get the two? And when B writes, okay. Anyone else have different answers? Yeah.
Also, if B reads from the file,
Yeah, so reading from the file is probably another system call, assuming the file isn't the keyboard. Okay, and so that's the lower number I got. And you might say, well, this seems actually low because, well, maybe we have to open the file. Maybe that's a separate system call. You know, maybe this is, you know, multiple reads. Maybe you have to read multiple times because there's a big, it's a big file. So you could say, like, you could, so I think 3 is probably the lower bound, but you can go higher. And that's, like, completely fine. You could also say you have to read multiple times. Maybe I'm typing a lot of stuff on the keyboard. It's multiple actual read system calls. That would be a reasonable guess to make. But 3+, okay? So how about for context switches? Yeah.
Four or more.
So where are the context switches?
We assume A was running, and then the timer interrupt, the context switch is running. And then once the, all the interrupts from 1, 2, 3, like the system calls come back, and then have that function return a context switch back to A.
So your model is that A is running, then we do 1, then A is running again?
Yeah.
Okay, and then A is running again. And your idea is that reading from the keyboard, we have to wait for that. So we're gonna, so process B can't be running, and the operating system's not gonna say, I'm not gonna run anything right now, it's gonna run A. That's your model. Yeah. And that's, roughly the guess I got. So I said, you know, so we switch. So I did it slightly differently, but say, we make the call to read, we switch to A while B waits. So the key idea is that if we're waiting for something else to happen, then we're not going to run the program that can run right now. So we'll have those context switches, just to B, to read from a file, and maybe reading from the file requires waiting, maybe it doesn't. But if it does, then we might switch to A while we're waiting for the information to come from, say, a disk. And then we switch to B to do the computation in the write, and then we can switch back to A. Question is, which exceptions result in a system call? So a system call is a kind of exception. And like a timer interrupt and a fault are other kinds of exceptions. And remember that system calls are a way for code running in user mode to go into kernel mode. And since exceptions are handled in kernel mode, they are not going to cause system calls directly. Now, something indirect might happen. So for example, I press a key on a keyboard that triggers an interrupt because of the key press, then the operating system might decide, I'm going to run this program. That program later on might make a system call, but it's not during handling that key press. It's when we've gone back to the program and it's getting the result of its I asked to read from the keyboard system call, which could possibly be much later on. Is that clear?
Yeah.
So that's a good question. Other questions? Oh, right, I should do this. Yeah?
Once everything in B is done, would it switch automatically to A?
The question is, once everything in B is done, would it switch automatically to A? So assuming my description of B was complete and it would exit, yes. And that's because B would make a system call to exit, which we learned about last time. And the result of that system call is, the operating system would say, oh, there's nothing else to run but A, might as well run A. Yeah?
The context
The question is, how does the context switch happen? And that is, in fact, our next topic. And we'll look at how it happens in XV6. There are other ways of doing the context switch, but we're going to talk about how it happens in XV6. So in XV6, context switching between processes always happens in kernel mode. And the way it happens is first we have an exception happen, and we start the trap function. And then something that the trap function calls decides, I want to run a different program. And it switches from the kernel stack of the program that was running before to a new kernel stack. And that new kernel stack happens to be set up such that it can return from the trap function with a different kernel stack pointer and then start running a different program. So this is part of why I said we have one kernel stack for each process. So to switch between two processes, we switch to first to the kernel stack of that process. And then we're in the kernel, we exit the kernel and start executing that process in user mode, and that's our full context switch. And this has the major advantage that we only write the code to save and restore our registers once. We have a copy of the code that saves all the user registers for any type of exception, and a copy of the code that later restores all the registers for any type of exception. And that's what we use to handle the registers of the applications. Just as if we had a system call versus a context switch, same code handles switching those registers off for the user registers. Now, of course, there's the interesting question of when we switch from using one kernel stack to another, what is happening? You know, how does that work? And that's what we're going to spend most of our time talking about, because it is by far the most confusing part of the process. And there's this XV6 function called switch. You might wonder, why is the I missing? And the answer is that with the I, it's a keyword. That's the only reason. And what it does is it saves the kernel registers for, say, a process A and restores them for B. So it's the context switch, but only kernel mode to kernel mode part of the context switch. So this is separate from saving and restoring the user registers. And there's an additional step to the context switch that we'll talk about a little more later when we talk about address spaces and so on, where we switch the address spaces. We'll just kind of gloss over that today. Okay. So given the setup, the way things work is that if we're switching from one process to another, we have our from process. It has its own stack in its, you know, the address space. And it also has a kernel stack that the kernel uses. And it turns out that this kernel stack can be read by anything that runs in kernel mode. And that's important for this. There's also something called a process control block. And this is where we store information about a process for something like, I want to wake up this program, how do I find the program? You give me the process control block, that's how I find out all the information about it. It's sort of the index for everything we know about the process. We'll talk more about what's in it next week. But one of the things it contains is a kernel stack pointer. And we have our context here. So when we have an exception happen in the from process, remember we said that we save the registers that were happening in user mode, and we save those, in fact, on the kernel stack. That's where that trap frame argument to the trap function, where, for example, we saw reading EAX from syscall to figure out what syscall was it, it's actually reading from the kernel stack. And that's just because the assembly code that handles an exception saves the information there. So later on, while we're handling this trap, we might decide, oh, okay, we're executing from, but really I want to switch to two. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to figure out what program do I want to switch to, and we're going to get a pointer to two's process control block, and we're going to look up two's kernel stack pointer, and we're going to use that to actually do the switch of the kernel registers. And the way XV6 has chosen to implement this function, just a design choice, is that they save the kernel registers on the kernel stack and restore them from the other kernel stack. And that's why we have a kernel stack pointer in the process control block. Because that's what we're using to figure out where everything is. So we find out where the kernel registers are, and once we restore that, we just use this stack to return from a bunch of functions until we eventually restore the saved user registers. We don't actually need a direct pointer to the user registers, though it turns out XV6 does save one. Okay. So questions on this idea here? Yeah. So the kernel stack pointer is how we find, these saved kernel registers. So if I want to switch to a different process, I need to figure out where is its stack to find those registers to actually run it. Okay. So let's look at this, how this switch function is that does the kernel stack switch is used. So here's its prototype. It takes a pointer to a pointer to a context. And the context just has the saved registers. And it also takes a pointer to the context to switch to. So the old pointer, we're going to allocate space on the stack, set the pointer to point to that. Remember, we have a pointer to a pointer. So we're going to set, so star old equals the top of stack. Stack. And therefore, and the top of stack is equal, is, you know, where we saved the registers. And my handwriting is apparently very bad today. But we're going to save the registers on the top of the current stack. And then we're going to use the new context, and we're going to set the registers based on that. And one thing you might say is, okay, we're missing some things here, like, you know, if you remember your x86 assembly, you might say, okay, I know this is 32-bit, but doesn't 32-bit x86 have more than 5 registers? And also, is one of them really EIP? What's going on? We'll get to that in a bit. So first of all, talk about EIP. So EIP is the saved program counter. So as part of this switch, we're going to end up returning from the switch function, not to where we called it, but to the location set in EIP. So this is, so we're going to set, we're going to save our return address in EIP. So when we switch back to old, we'll return to the same place where we called it. I'll show an example in a bit. And we'll return from the call to switch to where new says it should return to. So the way this looks when we use it is that we have a context for A and a context for B. And let's say this is thread A. So thread A is running here. We're at 1. We're going to call the switch function, and we're going to save the registers for A in A context. And we're going to restore the registers for B from B context. And what that's going to do is that B called switch earlier. And making this call to switch is going to end up returning from that earlier call to switch in B. Yes?
Why does A context pass by reference?
So the question is, why is A context pass by reference? And the answer is because the switch function is, in fact, going to allocate space for it rather than modifying an existing context. So it's going to allocate new space for it on the stack. So we aren't saying write to this memory location. We're saying allocate space for the context and tell me where that space you allocated. And that's why we have a pointer to a pointer there.
So that's not the same thing for B.
For B, the space is already allocated, so we only pass a single pointer to it. We don't need to change where it's allocated. We just use the existing allocation. Yes?
How do you, I know this was omitted, but like on the switch function, but how do you know exactly like where locations in the kernel stack and what is the user when you actually switch and store stuff?
The question is, how do I know where the kernel and user stack is? So when we call the switch function, we will only be calling it from kernel mode because it doesn't, you know, and we'll just have a convention that we always call it with when we're using the kernel stack. So every time we save this context value, we're always saving a kernel stack pointer. We don't need to worry about which is the user stack. Does that answer your question?
I'll just keep listening.
Yeah. Well, we'll have some more review. This is seriously the most complicated thing in this class. Yes.
So once it swaps the two contexts, does it registers one by one when the context is switching to?
The question is, when we swap those two contexts, do we assign the registers one by one?
Yes.
So what we call swapping those two contexts includes not just returning here, but when it returns here, the registers have the value they had when B made this call earlier. So we've restored the values as part of that return. Yeah?
So is part of switching also deleting where we've saved the context of B? Or
part of switching deleting what?
So when we're switching from A to B, do we then, as part of that, so we copy all the registers that are saved in the context of B, and then do we delete where B is saved?
The question is, do we remove the information about, you know, this pointer B context? And we don't actually change the value of the pointer, but after we've returned, that pointer is no longer useful. And it's no longer useful because it points to a stack that we're currently executing on, and you shouldn't change or things will break because, like, now we're down here, and we're using local variables that might be using that same space where the context used to be. But XV6 doesn't bother actually like nulling out the context or anything like that. It just lets dangerous things happen if you make mistakes. Yes?
I know we're only doing two processes right now, but like hypothetically, if you were to context switch from A to B and from B to C, if A like lower the stack than B, how would you return this? If A wanted to go from C back to A, how would you go?
The question is, if we go from A to, if we had a thread C, could we also go from B to C and then from C back to A? And the answer is yes, and that would work. And there's not something special about that because this context pointer is all we need, all the information we need to know how to switch to B or A or C. So that pointer that we're passing, that I'm passing as B context here, I can use that from any thread to switch back to B.
So everything's always
stored on the stack. So, and the reason that works is because it's all the information is stored together on the stack of the thread we're switching to. We don't have to worry about where did we leave it. We know we left it in the same stack that it was executing on. Good question. Okay. So we switched, returned now to B. And later on, maybe B decides I want to switch back to A. So in that case, we'll have a, you know, we'll call switch, and this call to switch that switches back to A will return from the original call to switch in A. And, you know, it's just as if that switch call executed B for a little bit, then returned, as far as A's point of view is. Yeah?
How is the call to switch triggered from the yield?
So the question is, how is the call to switch triggered from the yield? We will talk about this in much more detail when we talk about how the scheduler works in XV6, which we'll do in a couple weeks probably. Basically, there's some if statement which says if something is true, then call switch. Yeah.
For the switch in thread B, the first switch, would that be the same as the switch also in the second switch?
So the question is, could these two calls to switch be the same? And the answer is yes, and they could also be different. Like, maybe here, B switched to thread C, and then C switched back to A. Like, it doesn't have to actually be just two threads. Yeah?
Is there a maximum number of threads?
The question is there a maximum number of threads? And the answer is, well, how many kernel stacks can we have?
So that depends on memory.
So yes, which means it depends on how much memory we have. Okay. So other questions on? Yes. Yeah.
Do the threads ever overlap because of the stack? Like say if one stack grows too big, will that ever interfere with another stack?
So the question is, like, what if a thread stack gets too big? Is this going to cause problems? And the answer is, if you use too much space on the stack, yeah, you're going to have problems in XV6. So XV6 has made a choice that kernel threads are always exactly 4 kilobytes. And if you go beyond those 4 kilobytes, XV6 doesn't even try to detect the situation. Just bad things are going to happen. You're going to be writing some other memory. It might not even be another stack. It might be something else, you know. And this is actually pretty common in kernel code that they won't, you know, they'll have very small stacks because they want it to be efficient, and they assume that the people programming the kernel are going to be disciplined about not allocating big arrays and things like that. Maybe not a good assumption, but a common assumption. Okay, so other questions? So here's the actual assembly code for the switch function, where we can answer the question about like exactly where every register goes. Note that this is 32-bit x86 assembly, so the arguments to this function are on the stack. So what these first two instructions are doing are reading the two arguments, old and new, those two, that pointer to a pointer and that pointer, into EAX and EDX. Okay. So we load those two values, and then, remember I said we allocate space on our current thread stack for the save registers. And we saw earlier we had this list of registers here, EDI, ESI, EBX, EBP. So we had EBP down here. And here we push EBP, EBX, ESI, and EDI. So we push in reverse order to get exactly that struct on the stack. Then we copy the stack pointer that we got after doing that into the pointer to, using the pointer to pointer. So I said we allocate space and set the pointer. This is the line which does it. So we have our pointer to pointer. We're setting the single pointer by copying our stack pointer into it. Then we take our single pointer in EDX, make that our new stack pointer, and we know that when we save that stack pointer, we had just done in thread B these push calls. So we undo those push calls by pop, 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 pop in reverse order. So a complaint you might have is, well, what about the other stuff? Like, I didn't save EAX. What happens to EAX? I kind of need EAX to run my program. And the answer is, well, EAX in the calling convention is saved by the caller, so we don't have to worry about it. Because switch was called, we know EAX is somewhere else on the stack. So we don't have to worry about it. Same with ECX and so on. ESP, the stack pointer, we don't need to save explicitly because it's exactly the pointer we're using as the context. So you don't need to do any extra work to restore that correctly. And the program counter, the place we return to, well, that's the return value that's below these things we pushed on the stack. So when we return, because we're using the stack that called switch originally, we're going to return to the place where it was originally called from in the appropriate thread on that stack. Okay, so questions? Yeah, so I think I have. So here's our picture of what things look like. So we have our from program and our to stack where everything is already saved, you know, because during a previous call. And our stack pointer initially points to the return address of switch because that's how function calls work on x86. And then we push all those registers. And then we do this thing to swap our stack pointers to the stack pointer of the place we want to switch to. Then we pop all those registers, and you know, when we execute that return, it points to the switch return address from the thread we're switching to. And after we return, above the arguments to switch are the caller save registers. Because we made a function call, we had to save EAX and so on. The compiler did that for us, and that's going to handle the rest of the registers. Okay, so questions? Yeah. So initially, our stack pointer pointed to the switch return address, because that's beginning of a function call. And we had already saved the caller save registers like EAX and so on, because we made a function call, and that's just part of making a function call. So then this function pushed these registers, EBP and so on. Then we switch from the from stack to the to stack. So this is the thread which called switch way long ago. So we're now popping its save registers from the stack. And then we return. And return's going to look at what's the address, return address on the stack. And it's not going to look at the return address I just called switch with. It's going to look at the one from long ago in that other thread. Yeah. The question is, why is it given that we always save EAX and ECX and so on? Because the way the x86 calling convention that XV6 uses works, EAX and ECX are caller-saved registers. So if you care about their value, you have to save them to call a function like switch. So it's not actually guaranteed that they're saved, but we know if they're not saved, the kernel code can't be using them.
So if you wanted to go back, you could essentially start back at the top again.
Yeah. So if you wanted to go back, we push the registers back on, switch over here, pop, and go back up. And then we'll return, and so on. So this is this is what ends up being in both. And this is the important part. Like, when we set the stack pointer, conceptually we're in the new thread. New process versus before we're not. And we always have this save things at the bottom of our stack. Okay, so questions here? Okay, so now, we need the bigger picture here. So I told you how we switch between two kernel threads. So what happens when we're switching between two user programs is that we have the save user registers from the call to trap way, way above this on the stack. Then that call to trap eventually calls the switch function, and we get all the way down here. Then we restore the registers for the kernel. We return back to whatever exception handler was running when the program we were running stopped. So for example, let's say the program I'm switching to made a read system call to read from the keyboard. So it called switch because it said, I don't have input right now. And we switch back to it. After it has input, that's where this return address is going to point. So it's going to finish handling that read system call. That read system call is going to return to the trap function. The trap function is going to return, and that's going to restore these saved registers up here. Does that make sense? Questions? So that's our. All right, so that was why I got. This is a good, reasonable summary picture. So when we switch from one program to the other, we have an exception. We have a stack pointer before it. We save that in the save user registers, trap, which is, trap returns to code which deals with that. And then eventually we decide to switch to another program. And we go in reverse. We restore the kernel registers. Then we end up in the middle of a different call to trap. We return from that. We restore the user registers and have a different stack that we return to. And we have to put this together. We have to find the program. So we have to save the kernel stack pointers. And we just save that. And it turns out as struct proc, which we'll talk about more probably next time. So before we leave, because I have time, let's do give you 15 seconds to look at this. And then we'll ask what we think it is. So who thinks the answer is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, N, E? Okay, most people didn't have enough. You didn't have enough time. We'll talk about this next time, naturally. Yeah. What's the answer? And so the answer is loop.exe's kernel stack.
So just going back, if two of those threads are running and let's just say a context switches and that one ends, does it know to go back